Good evening. My name is Whitney Moyer, and I am a student supervisor at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum and the Political Science Department, it is my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's event, The End of Slavery. According to United Nations statistics and other sources, an estimated 27 million people worldwide are held in slavery, the majority in the South Asian countries of India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Nepal, with significant numbers in Africa and South America. Additionally, countries once a part of the former Soviet bloc are releasing slaves to many countries in Western Europe, North America, and Southeast Asia. Despite the importance of these statistics, the pitfall of focusing mainly on the most concentrated and brutal slavery hotspots is that we compartmentalize slavery as something that is happening somewhere else to someone far removed with little we can do. In fact, we need look no farther than our own country to find the fastest growing form of slavery, called contract slavery, in which the poor, weak, and young are tricked with the promise of legitimate work. In the United States, slavery cases are being investigated in all 50 states. We are fortunate to have Dr. Kevin Bales here with us this evening. Dr. Bales is one of the world's leading experts on modern slavery and child trafficking. He is president of Free the Slaves and author of Disposable People, New Slavery in the Global Economy, which was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. He is also the winner of numerous international humanitarian awards. In December 2008, Utney Reader named him one of 50 visionaries who are changing your world. Bales earned degrees in sociology, anthropology, and economic history from British and American universities, including the London School of Economics, where he earned his PhD. Currently, Dr. Bales is Emeritus Professor of Sociology at Roehampton University in London, visiting professor at the Wilberforce Institute for the Study of Slavery and Emancipation at the University of Hull, and serves on the board of directors of the International Cocoa Initiative. At this time, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and other electronic devices. In addition, please hold any questions until the end of the presentation when there will be a brief question and answer session. Out of courtesy to those who are hearing impaired, and because we are taping this event, we ask that you raise your hand and wait for a microphone to reach you before asking your question. Thank you for your cooperation. Now, please join me in welcoming Kevin Bales.
Thank you. Thank you, Whitney. Now, I need to turn off my phone. She reminded me, and I'm just going to just flick the little switch. Okay, thank you. Because otherwise, it would have rung. And it may still, but anyway. Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here. I know we want to only run for about 40 minutes with me talking, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time doing it, but I want to say thank you to the Clark Forum for the great supper. In fact, I may doze off. There was a lot of apple pie, and we kind of had seconds, and it was, you know, it was a lot, but it was a wonderful thing for me. What I'd like to do is a couple of things. First, I want to show you a short film. I want to show you a short film about slavery around the world today, because it may be that this is an issue that you've heard about, but you're not desperately familiar with, so I'd like to kind of expand that. And then I'd like to talk a little bit about how did we get to a situation where we have an awful lot of people in slavery in the world today. You know, if we have 27 million people in the world in slavery, how on earth did we get to that point? And then I want to finish up and tell you what we're going to do about it and how we're going to bring it to an end. So I think if I push this button correctly, we should be able to start this film.
There are 27 million slaves in the world today. Men, women, and children held against their will. Forced to work without pay. Controlled by violence every day.
Slavery is what slavery has always been. It's about one person completely controlling another person using violence and then exploiting them economically, paying them nothing. That's what slavery is about.
Slavery is not legal anywhere, but thriving everywhere. in Africa, Asia, and here in the United States. The CIA reports 50,000 women and children are smuggled into the U.S. each year as sex and domestic slaves, or locked away in sweatshops, tricked into coming here with offers of a good job and an education, terrorized into staying. It happened to Dora, Christine, and Rosalie.
I get up around 6 o'clock, something, 6:30. I go back to bed, around 2:30. I was helping her, taking care of the kids, doing everything in the house. You know, I wasn't getting paid and stuff. So I live in the house for about 3.5 to 4 years. They used to hit me. I can't go for 3 days without them beating me up.
Dora escaped by jumping from a moving car. Ironically, she was enslaved in this house by an official of the World Bank, an organization that supposedly tries to alleviate the plight of the world's poor.
Dora's been talking about working here, and we'd like to give your mum the opportunity to tell her side of the story.
Joyce Arimka works with freed slaves in Washington, D.C.
There is so little awareness. Americans don't want to believe that modern-day slavery is occurring.
Listen, on the wind you hear their voices. On a strong wind, you can feel the sweat of their despair, fear and pain. Will you listen?
In India, thousands of children have been kidnapped by slave traders or tricked into slavery in the carpet belt. 5,000 children are missing in the poor, remote region of Bihar.
My son, Hero, was just 6 years old when he disappeared with a cousin. When I couldn't find him, I thought I was going mad. I felt so empty inside because my child was missing. His mother, too, was going mad.
Hero's been gone 5 years. He doesn't even know some of his younger brothers and sisters. Chiche's best shot at seeing his son again lies with the South Asian Coalition Against Child Servitude, or SACS. The organization rescues 3,000 children a year from slavery. SACS thinks it's found Hero.
I just pray to God that my child will be found. The moment he sets eyes on me, he'll start to weep, and he won't stop.
Chiche comes for the raid on the loom.
You may choose to turn away, but one thing is clear. Oh, if you listen, you will hear. Oh, the voices of a million souls. Helpless, homeless souls. Into slavery, bought and sold.
At last, Chiche has found his son.
If you listen, you will hear. Oh, in a rise of desperation. It's the shame of the nations. If you listen, you will hear.
These young men are slaves in Africa.
They're working on the lower end of the economic ladder. It tends to be raw materials, agriculture, basic stuff that feeds into the local economy. But all over the world, there are also slaves making things that feed into the world economy.
Things like cocoa. Half the world's cocoa comes from the Ivory Coast. Many cocoa farms there use slaves, which means that some of the chocolate we eat comes from slave labor.
In the old days, slaves were expensive. Today, they're cheap. There's a glut of slaves, and when you've used them, you throw them away if you don't want them anymore. They're disposable.
Slaves like these men cost the equivalent of $40,000 in the Deep South during the 1850s. Today, the average slave cost $90. A local journalist in the Ivory Coast uses an undercover camera to show just how easy it is to get a good deal on people. It takes 30 minutes and about $80 to buy these two men. They come from Mali, hoping to work for a better life. Their purchase in the market turns out to be just a warning for the men who so narrowly avoided slavery.
He said that if anyone escaped, he would be caught and killed.
No one warned these 19 young men from Mali. They demonstrate the beatings they survived. Others weren't so lucky. They've never even tasted chocolate.
When people eat chocolate, they're eating my flesh.
The people watching this may think, well, why don't we just stop buying chocolate? But I have to tell you, that can actually make things worse. We have to make it clear to the multinationals that slavery is too high a price to pay for cheap goods.
There are pockets of success around the world in preventing slavery, freeing slaves, and rehabilitating those that have been freed. Not too long ago, 30,000 people were enslaved in Brazil, making charcoal for the steel industry. The public outcry forced change. Within 3 years, all the slaves were freed. Kevin Bales recently testified in Washington, D.C. Penalties against traffickers are now tougher. In West Africa, Free the Slaves has worked with the chocolate industry and other organizations to uncover the exact extent of the slavery problem. Together, they are building an inspection system that will take slavery out of chocolate for good. And in India, Sachs not only rescues children from slavery, it also mends their spirits and educates them, making them leaders when they return to villages where almost no one can read or write.
If you are illiterate, anyone can cheat you. If I am literate, no one can cheat me.
Such schools are funded by the Rugmark Foundation that investigates and ensures consumers that children have not labored over the expensive carpets. The Rugmark stamp adds about $2 to the cost of a rug.
And we believe that's a small price to pay for that peace of mind, that by buying that rug, you're not getting involved in the child slavery problem.
Also in northern India, women have formed small credit unions and bought their freedom. Achieving economic independence means they no longer fear debt bondage and slavery. Their increased incomes now support local schools for the children they have taken out of the workplace. Free the Slaves, an American-based nonprofit organization, is supporting these programs and more, including encouraging governments to enforce their own anti-slavery laws. There are more slaves today than at any other time in human history.
Every one of us is benefiting from slavery around the world. We could eradicate slavery. The laws are in place. The multinationals, the World Trade Organization, the United Nations, they could end slavery. But they're not going to do it until and unless we demand that they do it.
Now is the time.
You know, I have to tell you, I accidentally queued up the wrong film. That's not the tremendously wrong film, but that was actually just the old film. We have a new version that's very updated. And so if you want to see that, you can go to our website, and it's right there. You can watch it on the website. So there's some things in that film that I realized, oh, I put up the old one. And so you actually got some old information. But if it was new to you, then it was new information. So I guess we're okay that way. If you see, you know, when you go around the world, as we quickly did in that film, and you see different types of slavery around the world, I can imagine that you're thinking, how on earth do we get to that situation? How on earth can we get to a situation where people in hereditary debt bondage, children are being kidnapped into slavery, there's trafficking across many borders, there's a lot of different situations in which that kind of people, those kind of people, the other kind of people who are vulnerable, people just like us, in fact, who are vulnerable, who are caught up in in the idea that they wanted to make their lives better and then caught up in human trafficking and so forth. How on earth did we get to a situation like that? So that's what I want to talk about first and say a few things. I want to be absolutely clear, though, that I'm talking about real slavery. I'm not talking about sweatshop work where people can make terrible salaries, but they can walk away. They are able to walk away if they're in, you know, they have bad jobs, but they can walk away. I'm talking about people who can't walk away. In fact, when we're in the field and we're not quite sure what we're looking at, and we're saying, is that slavery that we're looking at in the field right here? Our rule of thumb question is to say, can they walk away, even into a worse situation? Because if you have the freedom to make bad choices, which we all do, that's one of the things about being free, is that you can choose to screw up your life, right? Or you can choose to take risks. But if you're in slavery, you can't even do that. And the point is that the people who are in slavery, the core of slavery, the heart of slavery, no matter whether it's packaged as a legal institution or an illegal institution, or it's packaged as being something reflecting gender or ethnicity or race or whatever, the core of it is that a person's completely controlled by another person, that violence is used to maintain that control, that they work without payment, and especially that they're being used to make profit for someone, that there's economic exploitation. All slavery throughout all history has been about using people to put money in your pocket. Because otherwise, I have to say, you can look and look, but it's very difficult to find people who enslave people to be mean to them. Even though we think of slaveholders as mean people, that's not their motivation. Their motivation is profit. That's a narrow definition. That's more narrow than some of the United Nations definitions and some legal definitions. But you use that as a narrow definition, and you still, as a working definition for the research, and you still come to something like 27 million people in the world in that situation of complete control and economic exploitation. Now, how on earth did we get so many people in that situation? Well, in fact, there's been something of an explosion in slavery in the last 50 years, and a lot of it has to do with these three factors. These didn't necessarily cause the increase in slavery, but they're factors that supported it. And one of them is actually something we've been talking about at supper tonight. We had a lot of talk about the population explosion and population control and that sort of thing. But the truth of the matter is, as we all know, the world population went from 2 billion people about 50 years ago to 6.75 billion people today. It's the most astounding increase in the number of people on the planet Earth. Nothing like it in the entire history of the planet, except maybe lemmings or something, a species like that. But the point is that most of that growth is in the developing world. But that doesn't make people slaves. Having a lot of people does not make them slaves. You have to add in the other factors. A second important factor is the idea of vulnerability. Now, I say up here extreme poverty and all these possible things that can cause it, but the idea is that particularly among those people who are in the developing world who are more vulnerable because they are in countries where the rule of law is not so strong, they're in places where they have difficulty earning a living, they're in places where there are kleptocratic governments or where ethnic conflict or ethnic cleansing might have occurred, or where global warming has shifted or other kinds of environmental changes have shifted their ability to be subsistence farmers. Whatever that mixture is, or God forbid you live in a country that has had all of these things happen at once, like Liberia, where you have environmental impacts and disease and ethnic conflict and kleptocratic governments and civil war, and creates phenomenal vulnerability among the population. But that doesn't make people slaves either. To really turn people into slaves in the world today, you have to add that third leg to the stool. You have to bring in the lack of the rule of law. You have to remove the protections of the rule of law. Because, you know, we judge the quality of the rule of law according to how well it protects the vulnerable. Rich people, they can usually protect themselves pretty well, but when you look at a country and say, how well is the rule of law actually operating here, you say, how well does it protect the poor? How well does it protect the minority group? How well does it protect women and children? And if the rule of law will not operate, and you're vulnerable and poor And in a sense, without resources of your own, it means that those who can control violence, in other words, those who have access to weaponry or just power, can use that power to take control of you because you are not protected by the rule of law. And it's a fairly simple process. You don't manage to be protected. I have power. I can exercise power over you and begin to appropriate your labor. I can begin to take control of your life and use violence to take that control. Now, interestingly, most of the people who come into slavery today are not kidnapped. They're not, you know, rounded up at gunpoint. People don't come to slavery that way. In fact, now, I admit that showing this question to college students and some who will be graduating soon is a cruel, cruel irony of a presentation, because you're thinking, when will someone ever say that to me? And the answer is 5 or 6 years from now. But, you know, there's still Teach for America. You can, if they turned you down too? Okay. All right. Okay. Well, either way, the point is that most of the people who come to slavery, into slavery for the first time today, new slaves today, enter slavery because someone asked them this question. And it's very interesting. I've been told the same anecdote in essence, with slightly different details, in many countries around the world, in many continents around the world. And the anecdote always kind of runs like this. I was in my village, I was in my barrio, I was in my town, I was in whatever. And somebody came in and got up in the back of a pickup truck and they said, hey, I've got work, who needs jobs? And it's interesting that the people who tell me this story often then say, and you know, I looked at that guy and he looked really sketchy. And I thought, I don't know if I'd want to get in that truck. But my kids are hungry. But if we don't get some medicine, my partner's going to die of that infection. If I don't get some money, we're going to be cold in the winter because the roof's, you know. And for all of those reasons, they climb in the back of the truck and take the chance and go for the job. And they're driven off 100 miles, 500 miles, it could be 1,000. They end up trafficked thousands of miles. And they discover that when they get there, the work is dirty, demeaning, degrading, destructive to them, and maybe it's a lot worse than they were promised, but they still work at it for a while because they think they're going to get paid, and then finally they realize, no, this is horrible, and we're not getting paid, and they say, hey, boss man, this stinks, I'm leaving, you don't even have to pay me, and that's the day the guns come out. And they say, actually, you're not leaving, not until we tell you to leave, not until we let you leave, you're working here, that's the end of the story. Or worse, the real brutality begins. And the shock and the trauma of the physical assault begins to make it very clear what their reality is. Because they step into it because they do what you or I would do in the same situation. They are pursuing opportunity, sort of the thing that made America great, people coming here pursuing opportunity. But the result of that is that they step into a conduit that leads them into a situation of enslavement. Not every person who seeks opportunity ends up in slavery, but criminals are very clever about opening that door to opportunity so that people can walk into slavery. That slavery that they walk into, whether it's in a new kind of work or an old kind of work, digging ditches or breaking rocks or doing agricultural work that you saw in the film, it's pretty much the kind of slavery that's always existed, in the sense that the core of that slavery is still recognizable as it would be across all of human history. Total violent control, exploitation, economic profit-taking by people who are using violence to maintain that control. But there is one new thing about slavery. The one new thing is the fact that there has been a complete collapse in the price of human beings. Now, I don't know if Jason's still upstairs, if he can bring the lights down again. Aha, yeah, good. Because I was really struck a couple of nights ago when I found the perfect illustration of this point on late-night television, and I want to share that with you.
3 billion shares traded just this afternoon, and traders trying to tidy things up before the weekend, so things have been very hectic all day, and volumes the best we've seen for a month. Daphne?
May Jada live from the trading floor. Thanks, May. Okay, lively discussion guaranteed here as always as we get macro and talk commodities. Continuing here in the studio with our guest Michael O'Donoghue, head of commodities at Four Continents Capital Management. And we're also joined by Brent Lawson from Lawson Frisk Securities.
Happy to be here.
Good to have you with us, Brent. Now, gentlemen, Brent, where's your money going this year?
Well, Daphne, we've been going short on gas and oil recently and casting our net just a little bit wider. We really like the human being story a lot. If you look at a long-term chart, prices are at historical lows, and yet global demand for forced labor is still real strong. So that's a scenario that we think we should be capitalizing on.
Michael, what's your take on the people story? Are you interested?
Well, definitely. Non-voluntary labor's greatest advantage as an asset is the endless supply. We're not about to run out of people. No other commodity has that.
Daphne, if I may draw your attention to one thing, that is that private equity has been sniffing around, and that tells me that this market is about to explode. Africans and Indians, as usual, South Americans, and Eastern Europeans in particular are on our buy list.
Interesting. Michael, bottom line, what do you recommend?
We're recommending to our clients a buy and hold strategy. There's no need to play the market. There's a lot of vulnerable people out there. It's very exciting.
Exciting stuff indeed. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Please stay with us. We'll be back after this short break with further insights into this fascinating market.
I was shocked. I had no idea. Okay, don't. Sometimes, when there's students in the audience, there'll be one who in the back who wasn't quite paying attention, will leap up and say, "That's outrageous." That's not actually real. That was a spoof. It's just as an illustration. Okay, there's a little relief in the back there. I'll tell you. Oh, yeah, okay, good. In fact, that's a film that that I made with MTV for MTV Europe, and we're going to start dropping it in between the music videos, but without any explanation, so it just looks like somebody hit the remote and went over to the business channel. What do you think? That's the plan, anyway. That's the plan. Here's the reality of that situation. If you look at the price of slaves over time, and you look at the, and I've charted it here against the population growth over the last 4,000 years, what you basically see is the yellow dots and the left-hand y-axis can be read in tens of thousands of U.S. dollars. So the average price of an average slave, which is what this is measured, has been around $40,000 in today's money for something like 4,000 years. It's been up a bit, down a bit, but it's averaged around $40,000 in today's money. And you can see that at the point at which the population explosion really begins to occur, you also have a complete, you have a collapse in the price of human beings. And you saw this in that short film. That was a very obvious kind of illustration of that. Because do you remember, we went into that market with a hidden camera. Actually, we didn't. It was Honoré, a guy who works with us, with a hidden camera, and he bought two young men for, do you remember? It was 80 for two, $40 each. $40 each. Now, compare that to what we know about slavery in the Deep South. If you look, that's one of the places where slavery is very, and the price of slaves has been very carefully documented. If you go back and look at the records, the average price of an average slave in, say, 1850 was about $1,000 to $1,200, $1,850, which was about $40,000 in today's money. And an average slave in the 1850s, the type that you would see most often advertised was what was called usually a young male that was called a prime field hand. It meant a young 19-year-old, 20-year-old guy who was strong, who could do good agricultural work. $40,000. Not the most expensive slave, not the cheapest, but the average. So how much did we pay for those 19, 20-year-old strong agricultural workers? $40. That's a phenomenal collapse. An absolutely phenomenal collapse. And it seems to have occurred across the planet Earth. So that it's true, if you need to buy a slave in the United States, you may pay up into the thousands because it's more expensive in a country where the rule of law applies and you have to kind of hide it away and like that. But I've also met families in their fourth or fifth generation of enslavement against what was called a debt, but was actually an acquisition or a purchase price, of around $10. So five generations for $10, or $2 a generation.
It means that the price of human beings has reached such a phenomenal low that the fundamental economic equation of slavery has been altered. That the expensive slaves of the past, who were seen as capital purchase items, were terribly treated, but often kept alive because they represented an investment, whereas people in slavery today are so inexpensive that they're treated more like plastic pens, more like styrofoam cups. An input to a process, an economic process that you can use as hard as you like. You don't need to worry about care. You don't need to worry about medical support. And then when you're done, you crumple them up and you throw them away. And that's certainly been the case with, again, many of the people I've met in slavery. Here's a disposable person. This incredibly gorgeous little girl was one of a whole number of kids that we brought out of slavery in the fishing industry around Lake Volta in Ghana. She and all those kids, in fact, were rescued on the same day. You know, her situation was simply that she didn't answer the question, do you want a job? But her mother answered it for her. And it wasn't about her mother selling her or anything like that. She lived in a village far up from the lake. There was no school. There was no access to medical care. That mother had trouble feeding her kids. And when the situation arrived that somebody who seemed nice, who seemed reasonable, who seemed like they might represent opportunity, said to her mother, you know, we've got some jobs that would be perfect for your little girl down on the lake. She could help a little bit with the fishing and then maybe sit in the market with the fish to sell the fish, and she'll learn a trade and she'll have fish to eat and maybe she can go to school part-time. And the mom's in a devil's choice, you know, saying, if I let her go, I won't be able to take care of my girl, but if I do let her go, maybe she won't be hungry. Maybe she'll get a chance at an education. Which way do I go? How do I do this? And for her mother, she decided to take the chance that maybe her daughter could have a better life. And she let her go with what she didn't know was a trafficker who took her off to a completely different part of the lake, 50 miles away. She disappeared from her mother's life completely and was put to work in fishing, where they tie big stones to their ankles to lower them down to untangle nets. And if they get them up in time, they don't drown. If they don't, they do drown, and then they just roll them into the lake. They starve them. They sexually abuse them. It's horrific. I mean, they're truly disposable. And the children, if they're not pulled out in time, they don't usually make it into their teen years because the mortality rate is so high among the kids who are working in fishing. It's a tough one, and she's one that we managed to pull out, and we'll also work with her family and make sure that they're never fooled again, and they're also going to help make sure that they have the kind of economic stability that means that they will never be tempted again. It's a horrific situation, and so much of what I've just told you is kind of depressing. But this is where I want to shift the gears and begin to talk to you about how we get past this, how we get over this, how we get through this, how we make sure that there's never another little girl like that, that we have to look into her eyes and think, why did you end up being an enslaved child? Why did you end up being an almost a disposable input to the fishing business? Now, I know this is a little cryptic, but what I want to get at when I say more is less is the fact that we've got 27 million people in the world in slavery, which is a lot of people. It's double the number that came out of slavery, came out of Africa in the entire 350 years of the transatlantic trade. But it's also the smallest fraction of the global population to ever be in slavery. So the 27 million people in slavery today is the smallest part of the world population that's ever been in slavery. And they generate about, that 27 million generate about $40 billion a year in productive capacity, in output, in economic output. That's a lot of money, but it's also the smallest fraction of the global economy to ever be represented by slave labor, by slave output. The fact of the matter is that while it sounds like a big number in both directions, people and output, it's the tiniest part of our human experience to ever be represented by slavery. And without quite being obvious to us, because it's a hidden crime, and because we may be confronting it and thinking, my gosh, this is a big situation, the fact of the matter is that in many ways, slavery as an institution in our planet has been pushed up to the edge of its own extinction.
And with the right kind of push again, we can knock it over the precipice and actually be done with it. Now, how on earth do we do that? Okay. Well, here's what we don't have to do. We don't have to do this. We don't have to win the battles of the past. The organization that I work for is actually the American sister organization of a group called Anti-Slavery International, and I serve on the board of trustees there. We're kind of an old organization in Great Britain. In fact, we were the first organization. We were the first human rights group ever. We started in 1787, started the first anti-slavery campaign in 1787 in the first abolitionist movement. And the big fight that we had back then was to convince people that slavery was morally wrong. There were ministers standing in pulpits in 1787 saying, God says this is okay. Well, you can do this. This works. Certainly in the United States, that was the case. But over time, there was enough change of heart and mind to lead to the situation we live in today, where virtually every person on the planet is in agreement that slavery is morally reprehensible and we cannot allow it. And we don't have to get the laws passed. Virtually all the abolitionist movements of the past were about getting a law passed against slavery. But they're passed. There's a law against slavery in every single country. So that one's okay. And we're not fighting any big economic vested interests. There is no cotton industry that relies on slavery. There is no giant sugar industry representing, you know, half the national economy of Great Britain or whatever that rests on slavery. Slavery is this minute drop in the economic ocean of our planet that's maintained and profiting criminals. And if we stop all slavery and cut them off, that's okay, right? If they have a bad day, that's okay. We don't have to fight that fight anymore. We don't have to fight that vested interest. What we do have to do is to crack through on different levels, which are more about our minds and our understanding, and then sometimes about our collective pocketbooks. We're facing a situation where people are surrounded by slavery, and they're in both in the countries where they live and in the products that they use, the chocolate they eat, the coltan in their cell phones, the sugar in their coffee, the steel in their cars, the gold on their finger. And they're not aware of it. Slavery is touching us every day, and we're not aware of it. We need to bring that awareness to the point where I think most of us would say, I don't think I like this. Right? If I'm aware of this, I don't want to actually go on living in a world with slavery. I want to change this. And give people the chance on several levels to make and act through a commitment that I don't want to do this. Now, I put commitment up there not just for us. It's not like I'm going to ask you to come forward and make a commitment or anything like that. I'm particularly interested in the commitments that have already been made. And I'm particularly interested in the commitments that our governments have made to us that we will live in countries without slavery. Because when you pass a law, you are making a promise to your citizens. When you pass a law, you make a promise to the citizens, we're not going to allow this thing. But in this country, we allow this thing. It's really more through apathy than it is through complicity. But we allow slavery in this country in all sorts of ways by not bringing the resources to bear, by not bringing the training to bear for the police officers and the medical staff and the social workers and the teachers to make it possible, and for people anywhere in any neighborhood to so that they have the knowledge to look around them and say, boy, that looks like a funny situation over there at that house. I wonder where that little girl came from that's suddenly working in that house. And actually see and identify and understand that slavery could be right in their neighborhood. The slaves could be living next door. Now, maybe not in Carlisle, but possibly in Carlisle. And certainly where I live in Montgomery County, Maryland, where I can name four different cases of slavery that have been uncovered in the last 5 years, right? Out in the suburban neighborhoods. This is the nice middle-class suburban neighborhoods. We have to bring all of those to bear. But particularly the last one, based on those commitments made by our governments, to bankroll what we have to take this slavery out of our lives and out of our communities. Now, if I'm standing here in the middle of an economic crisis and I'm saying,
I want money. I want bankrolled money. I want resources. You're going to say, well, isn't this really expensive? I mean, how are we going to do this if we can't afford to, if we can't afford to give those big bonuses to the bankers, right? Well, the truth of the matter is that slavery is a tough problem, but solving it and bringing people out of slavery is not expensive. Here's an example. That family, I've known that family for 2 or 3 years now, but granddad there was born a slave. He was a hereditary slave, so his dad was a slave. We don't know if his dad's dad and so forth were slaves because they just don't have any memory of it, but granddad was born a slave, his son was born a slave, and his kids were born slaves in a hereditary form of collateral debt bondage in northern India, working in a quarry, right? Working in a quarry. Now, they all came out together, and they all came out together when community organizers that from our organization helped them to organize themselves and fight back and leave the slaveholders. But the total cost of that whole process, and not just getting them to freedom, but helping them to stand on their own feet afterwards, was about $120 for that family. Now, it's cheap because India is a very inexpensive place to live, and that's a very poor part of India. That little boy was in the same group as the girl you saw earlier, rescued from fishing in the fishing industry in Ghana. Costs are higher in Ghana. Something like $400 to take him out of that situation into a rehabilitation center, get him fed, medical care, psychological help, job training, basic education, etc., back to a family that you then help build some capital and some income so that they won't be in that same situation again. $400. Now, again, pretty inexpensive. If you want to get somebody out of slavery in the United States or pay for what's necessary to keep them out of slavery, the government budgets about $30,000 for that because things like medical care and legal representation are more expensive in this country, and everything's more expensive in this country. But $30,000 over, say, a three-year period, which I have to tell you is actually not enough for the people who come out of slavery in the United States. But how many people are in slavery in the United States? 40 to 50,000, conservatively. How many in India? About 10 million. There's an interesting point here that the number of people who are in slavery are most concentrated in the places where it will cost the least to help them to come out of slavery. And that if you average it out across the world, you know, the 50,000 a year it might take to take somebody out of slavery in Germany or Great Britain, the 30,000 here, the $120, and you average it out across where they live, it actually comes to something like this. The average is about $400. And you multiply that up times 27 million. Whitney, 27 million times, it's that much. It's $10.8 billion. Okay, that's a lot of money, $10.8 billion. Well, or I used to have to sort of convince people that it wasn't a lot of money until they started saying we have to bail out the insurance companies for $100 billion. Before they started saying Ford Motor Company has to have $98 billion, whatever it was. You know, I used to say, it's not $10 billion, it's not as much as you think. Now, that's chump change. They throw it around every week. It's like, oh, $10 billion here, $10 billion there. Pretty soon it adds up to a trillion. What are you going to do, you know? But the truth is, $10.8 billion in the global system is not much money at all. And here's the real test. Of the people in this room, how many of you, put up your hand please, if you buy your groceries on the internet and have them delivered to your home?
I
don't think they do that. You don't think they do that in Carlisle? It's just, you did that in Chicago once? The reason I ask the question is that Americans spend $10.8 billion a year on internet grocery shopping. That's another statistic, right? But they do. But every time I ask an audience who does this, there's like two people or at most put their hands up, and then I say, do you spend like $30,000 a year on your groceries? I mean, or $1 million a year? How does this happen? Because I can't find anybody who does it, and yet it costs $10.8. We're spending either that or some of you are doing it and you're not admitting it. I don't know which one it is. Organic food, it's about what we spend on blue jeans, it's about what Americans spend on going to the movies in a year. If anybody's from Boston, you'll know that that's actually now less than they spend on the Big Dig
to dig the tunnel under the Charles River to connect the two sides of Boston to Cambridge. I mean, it's in global terms, it's chicken feed, and it's not just for Americans to pay. This is for everybody to pay on the planet, and it's not just for this year. This is how much we think it's going to take for the whole period of getting people out of slavery if it costs that much, like 25 or 30 years. Now, okay, I'll tell you the truth. I think it'll go up. I think if we keep doing this over the next 20 to 30 years, inflation will rise and we'll probably spend $20 billion, which will be chicken feed in, you know, 2052 or whatever it takes, and we'll be there. Now, that sounds like still, okay, a lot of money, $10 billion, and I appreciate that none of us here have $10 billion. Or if you do, I'd like to chat with you after the talk. Okay. But the other thing that's exciting to me about that number is that it's not money down a hole. We don't have to spend it and get nothing for it. In fact, there's a return on the investment. One of the things that we've been measuring and researching very carefully around the world in our work with people who come out of slavery is this. What happens to families economically when they come out of slavery? How much more are they, when they work for themselves, what do they produce? What do they share? What can they bring to their communities? And we've discovered that at the minimum level, they generate an economic boomlet, I should say, in their local communities when people come out of slavery that takes the whole local economy into an upward spiral. This is double the amount that we just talked about for getting everyone out of slavery. But this is what freed slaves would be generating annually if the same number were taken just to the moderate poverty level of $2 to $3 a day. They would be generating this much annually, not over a 30-year period, but this much every year. The fact is that it lifts all boats when you get people out of slavery and you give them the chance to work for themselves. And I got to tell you, you know, when they do have a chance to make sure their kids have enough to eat or have a chance to go to school, they work like dogs. I'm not going to say they work like slaves. I'm going to say they work like dogs to do it. And they really want to be something that will sound odd to the American ear, but they really want to be consumers. But for them, consumption does not mean going to the mall, you know, and getting a new cover for their cell phone. It means three meals a day instead of one, school for their kids, a roof that doesn't leak, medicine when you're sick. That's what consumption means to them. And they'll do anything they can. They'll work really hard to get that. The work that they do, and one of the reasons why we spend so much time thinking about the work that they do in freedom, one of the reasons why we spend so much time taking people to liberation and then sticking with them for years afterwards, if necessary, until they achieve lives of dignity, is because as we began this work, we looked back and said, how has emancipation, how has liberation been achieved in other countries, and what can we learn from it? And we learned right away that we did not want to repeat the botched emancipation that happened in this country in 1865. We learned a lot by looking carefully at the fact that 4 million people were lifted up out of slavery in 1865 and then just dumped. No 40 acres and a mule, no access to credit, no access to asset formation, no access to education, political participation, full citizenship, and subjected to prejudice and discrimination and violence. And guess what? We're still paying the price today for botching the emancipation of 1865. And we said, if we can help people come out of slavery, not on our watch are they going to end up as third-class citizens for generation after generation. This is just absolutely unacceptable. Because you can't end slavery by just ending the enslavement and then not letting people achieve lives of dignity. So we work very hard and say, we're not done. Our work is not done until families are economically autonomous, they have basic education, they are feeling like they have the ability to participate fully as citizens, and slightly harder to measure, but they have a sense of their own dignity, that they have dignity and a sense of esteem, that they have a place in the world and it's their power to make that. When they're there, we say, fine, we're ready to move to the next family that needs to come out of slavery. Today, without having to
win the moral argument. Today, when there's a law against slavery in every country, today when the number of slaves is in fact this tiny fraction of the global population and their output is this tiny fraction of the global economy, today when the cost of getting people out of slavery and helping them to lead new lives is in fact a tiny fraction of what we're spending on Ford Motor Company,
right? Or the Chevrolet or whatever.
Really, the constellations are aligned because they're also aligned because we agree. You know, there's a complete, pretty much moral and political agreement that we don't want to live in a world with slavery. And we have to begin to think that through and say, well, if that's true and the opportunity is right before us, why don't we do that? Why shouldn't we do that? Particularly if doing it isn't going to completely transform the global economy, but it is going to make the global economy rise up a little more. It's going to help lift poverty from the bottom, because at the very bottom of the world of the very poor is the world of slaves. It's the very bottom end of it all that can be lifted up. We have to make that decision. And we have to think about it carefully because, you know, if we can't, even though we may be feeling a bit economically powerless this week, if you're a student, you're sort of always economically powerless, but if we live in a world, in fact, which is the North, the rich North, again, we may not be feeling very rich this week, but we live in a place where power, we know we have power. We have luxury, and we have political power, and we have economic power. And we can't say, let's choose to use that power to end slavery. Well, then, you have to begin to wonder, what good is it? You know, if we can't use it for something that basic, that true. And if we actually believe we can't do it or we choose not to do it, what we end up doing is simply letting other people jerk the strings that tie us to that slavery around the world. Because we're tied to it in so many ways, whether it's the people in slavery in our own country or the products that we use every day that have slave input. And if we begin to do that, and we just let ourselves be continued bound to that slavery, we really have to say, well, we may pretend to it, but are we really ourselves free? I want to finish with this a little quote from de Tocqueville. Back in 1787, when we started our organization, it started with a recent college graduate and a few other people, mostly Quaker business guys, sitting around a table in the top of a bookshop in London. And they weren't powerful people, and they weren't rich people, and they weren't politicians. They weren't royalty. They weren't anything special, right? But they sat down around that table that afternoon in May, and they said, let's plan the end of the slave trade. Let's embark upon a campaign to end the slave trade. Now, economic historians tell us that those people who sat around that table were taking on an industry which is the equivalent of the global car industry of today. It was that sort of size and economic power in the world of 1787. It would be as if I said, okay, guys, let's pull these chairs into a circle. Tonight, we are going to plot the end of the global automotive industry. Now, you'd think that's nuts. But it was even more nuts for them. Because who owned slaves? The royal family owned slaves. The Church of England had slave plantations. The entire national economy was resting upon cotton for the mills and sugar to export to the rest of the country. It was bankrolling all those palaces that you see, you know, on British television. It was part of the political system. It was totally legal, completely legal. It was accepted by the church and preached to be fine from the pulpit. And yet they said, we're going to take this on. And de Tocqueville, which we all remember from his work on democracy, in another book, wrote, if you look across all of human history, and in the section just before this, he was talking about people like Caesar, who we all remember, but whose legacy was destruction, war, death, ruin. He said, if you actually look across all human history, you see something without any precedent.
And he was talking about the 12 people sitting around that table. Nothing is anything is more extraordinary than those 12 people who chose to end the slave trade in all of human history. Okay, here's our gift. Our gift is that time, history, the cosmos have somehow placed us, you and me, in a situation where we can be something extraordinary in history. We can be a generation that brings 5,000 years of slavery to an end. The planet has never had a day without slavery in our history. The United States has never had a day without slavery in its history. But we could be the generation to say enough. That's the end. We stop. We stop right here, if we choose to. Okay, thank you so much.
I really appreciate your time. Of course, I'm going to answer some questions. Wait for the microphone. Bye, y'all.
Thank you, Dr. Bales.
Sure.
I find your work compelling and inspiring, and I've actually read all your books on slavery and have been quietly trying to educate people and bring awareness. And I wanted just as sort of a little testimony. I work for a church, and the teenagers in our church learned from your work. And on one day, they collected $780. It's a little church, about 100 members. $780 to send to free the slaves.
Thank you.
But I have a kind of a question, or at least I'd like you to comment. As much as I, yes, this is inspiring. Yes, we need to make this commitment. But I am also scared, concerned, that with climate change and global warming, people are going to be even more disposable, working against this. Can you just comment on that?
Sure. Yeah, it's a worry. I mean, I have to say, you know, every time, I'm going to back off your question for a second and then come right back to it and just say, we face a lot of significant challenges. We thought we had a huge breakthrough in the country of Mauritania last year, and we had had a tremendous breakthrough because the government had been replaced by a democratic government. The dictatorship had become... They came to us and said, can you help us plan the eradication of slavery in our country, which is very serious in that country? And we were moving along at a good clip, and then there was a military coup, and everything stopped. So, you know, sometimes it's two steps forward, one step back, and vice versa. There's certainly the case that the environmental changes that occur with global warming push people into situations of vulnerability. And for that reason, we may not be able to diminish their increased vulnerability, but we may be able to increase their protection under the rule of law. That's a tough one. That's a tough nut. And I honestly can't tell you one way or the other. We do feel that the fact that there are so few slaves in relative terms in the planet Earth, that if we can address those, it's true, we may not be able to reach everyone who has to suffer the negative impact of global warming and environmental change. But we also know that those ex-slaves mobilized can help lift that economic situation. And it's interesting that in India, one of the things that ex-slaves have been doing a lot in northern India, where we've done a lot of work with hundreds and hundreds of villages, is planting forests. They're planting forests like crazy. Because all the trees have been cut down in the national forest. It's weird. You're in the middle of a national forest, you can't see a tree. Not a one. They've all been cut down by the criminals who control the people in slavery. And now they're free, and they're planting trees like crazy. And we supply seedlings, sometimes with money from the World Bank. It's a weird kind of thing, but we buy the trees, and they plant the trees, and off they go. So I don't know. I mean, there's some tough times ahead. You know, 2030 is going to be an interesting kind of crunch time. Because, you know, the global population should peak at about 10.2 billion in 2030. We're looking at maybe the end of oil around 2030, or very difficult to get enough oil out. The impact of global warming is going to be accentuated by 2030. I'm taking the year off. I'm just going to, you know, go to a spa or something like that. So, no, I don't. You know, there I can see that. But you know what? We take the long-term view, right? We're going to work at this till there's no more slavery. And we think we can do it in 25 to 30 years. If we can't, we'll do it in 35 to 40 years. If we can't do it in that, we'll do it in 50 years. If we can't do it in that, we'll do it in 100. But we're going to do it. We know we're going to do it. It's just that we know that curveballs will be thrown our direction while it happens. But I appreciate that, you know, we worry about this too. We worry about this too. What's another question?
I too find your work very inspiring.
Thanks. Hold the mic up a little bit.
I'm sorry, okay.
Yeah.
I think my question is sort of a follow-up or related. I understand that some of money is enough to get these people out of slavery, but about the factors that push people into this, so about the factors that are causing poverty, one of which is the climate change, and there were others you listed, globalization,
lots
conflict,
of them. Yeah.
So on and so forth. Yeah. So would there be policy conclusions to tackle?
Yes. Well, yeah, what do we do to fight the underlying causes? And the answer is we fight the underlying causes as we perceive them in each place where they occur, because it's a different combination in different places. But we're always asking that question. And in some ways, I have to say that when I look at a lot of the other groups that work on this issue, one of the things that we often talk about with them is it goes like this. It's fantastic that you're breaking into brothels and you're getting women out of brothels and into a shelter and you're helping them achieve new lives, but did you shut down the brothel? Did you actually fix it so that no one else will ever go to that brothel? And that's part of the big problem, is breaking that cycle, that we work on it in many different ways. So that it's kind of hard to answer the question in a moment, except to say that we also know, and I mentioned this before, that the crucial underpinning factor is the rule of law. That if we can get the countries to enforce their law against slavery, which is difficult when there's governmental corruption, that can actually protect the people who are vulnerable in other ways. But sometimes that also means organizing the people who are vulnerable to protect themselves. And we see a diminution in areas of new freedom in governmental corruption, because we see that they, once they learn their rights and once they have a sense of empowerment as communities, they don't allow corruption to occur. But it's a slow process. And you're right. You know, there's a level of vulnerability there that must be addressed. And we do it in every way that we can. And in some cases, and here's one of the really tough ones as well, is just culture, right? It's just culture. It's about things that exist in the national or societal culture which say it's all right to treat women this way. It's all right to treat people of a caste or an ethnicity or a religious group this way. Are you Italian? Did I pick that up from your accent? No? Yeah. Oh, you're from Turkey. Okay. I just picked up a little bit, and I was thinking, because I remember being in Italy and being... My book came out in Italy and was very popular in Italy, and talking on television there once, and there was all this talk about the Nigerian woman problem. You know, in Italy, they have a lot of human trafficking from Nigeria into prostitution in Italy, and they kept going on about the Nigerian woman problem, the Nigerian woman problem. And I said, look, I'm sorry. I have some good news in one way, which is you don't have a Nigerian woman problem. And they were like, what? What are you talking about? And I said, no, you have an Italian man problem in this country. That's your problem. And created a big stink, and there were these editorials in the newspapers like, get the American out of here and all this kind of stuff. But the point was, you know, they didn't have a Nigerian woman problem. And part of their cultural problem was that they called it the Nigerian woman problem. They blamed the victims, while Italian men were buying sex and buying sex and buying sex, and thought that was perfectly okay. And it was a culture problem. It takes a long time to change culture. Now, but I grew up in the deep south of this country, and when I was a tiny boy, I can tell you, it was a different world down there. And it was a place where culture has changed. Has it changed enough? No. Has American culture changed enough? No. But it does change. Culture does change. And even Italian men can someday learn to be better. It may take 1,000 years, but, you know. Yeah. What's another question?
Hi.
Hi.
I'm very interested in this, but I unfortunately am not as aware about the issue as I should be. And I was wondering, as tickets and students, if you could give us something that we could do to help solve this problem. ourselves, because I know most of us probably can't donate massive amounts of money.
Okay. Can you? How about small amounts?
Okay.
Actually, I'm going to talk about small amounts in a second. But look, step one is learn. Okay. I know, for example, you have this book in your library. This is a book I published a little over a year ago. This is the plan to end slavery on the planet Earth. Okay. I didn't write it all by myself. I got a lot of people to help me put this together so we could figure out, okay, how do we actually do this? And the good news is, I'm going to say something nice about my book. A lot of people have decided that this is a viable plan. Bill Clinton has decided this is the viable plan. The Clinton Global Initiative is going to use this as their plan. They're going to start devoting all this international money and effort to turning this plan into a reality. So this is in the library, and I just left some copies at the Clark Forum. Okay, that's the best way. So you can go over there and get one and read it and so forth. Because you can't fix a problem you don't understand. Right? You got to learn. And then you want to say, okay, so the group that I'm in, the student group that I'm in, let's talk about how to do this together. Right? Let's talk about how to do this together. I know what you'd like to do as a student. I know what you'd like to do. You'd like to be that person in the movie that runs up to the door where the slave child is behind there, and you kick the door open, and you run in, and you grab the slave child, and you put him on your shoulder, and you run out. And as you run out, you punch the slaveholder in the nose as you go, and then you get outside, and then there's like this beautiful sunset, and the little slave child says, oh, thank you. You're safe, and so forth. I know that's what you'd like to do. We'd all like to be the action James Bond anti-slavery person, right? But the truth is we can't do that. We cannot do that from this country. What we can do from this country is sort of two things. One is begin to understand what's going on with slavery in this country and help people in this country to look around and see the slavery around them. If you go on our website, there's a booklet that's all about how to address slavery in your own community. Warning signs. What you need to know in your own community to see slavery in your own community and what to do about it. So it's right there on the website. And then the other thing is, it is actually true that small donations are really important, but particularly if they're regular. All the anti-slavery organizations in the world run on a shoestring. And to make it worse, they don't know if the shoestring is going to be there from one month to the next. It's really tough because the funding goes up and down, grants go up and down, people put in $10 this week but never nothing the next week. If you could just like give up 2 lattes a month, no joke, and send $5 a month. Pick your anti-slavery, anti-trafficking group and send them $5 a month, but just do it every month. Just put it on your credit card so it goes every month or whatever. That's the important thing, stability. To give, we can't solve this problem with a rock concert. We can't solve this problem with one appearance on Oprah. We've got to solve it by taking the long-term view, and that means $5 a month. From you, and you, and you, and you, and a couple of 100,000 people and $5, and we're getting there in a hurry. So you could do that. Yeah. There's a question in the back. Or in the middle.
Right. I just have more of a logistical question, just for curiosity's sake. When, the money is gotten to, the organization, what's the next step? How do you find these people in slavery?
Sure. Yeah, what happens? Sometimes we do it with no money because it just has to be done. But we do all our work with indigenous organizations on the ground in the places where the slavery is happening. So we do not parachute in, the American folk who come in and we're going to solve all the problems. We spend a long time hanging out with groups in countries all around the world that we think are doing a great job. And when I say a long time, I mean 2-3 years. We spend just hanging with them on a regular basis until we're completely convinced that this group is honest, straightforward, they understand you have to address the root causes, everything. And then we say, when we finally make a partnership, which means they can go through our books, we can go through their books, they can criticize us, we can criticize them, it's a real partnership. It's not we pay them to do stuff. Then we say, how would you solve the problem here? And we listen carefully and we say, that's fantastic. We love 95% of it. Have you thought about this little tweak or that little tweak from places we've learned to place else? And that's why, in some ways, it looks like Free the Slaves is really successful, But in fact, it's because we trust people who are on the ground and really know it, and they're the ones who are really successful. We just say, we're going to go up to the rich north and we're going to find the resources to let you to get you the what you need to do the job you know how to do already. And then we're going to help you with some training and different stuff like that. So that's the basic concept. Then it varies according to, do we need a shelter over here for kids? Do we need one over here? Do we need a credit union here? Do we need tools there? What does it take? Yeah. One more question? Or two? Because Amy's up here and wants to ask me. Okay.
Yes, ma'am. You mentioned in your video about multinational corporations.
Yes.
And then you also mentioned about government accountability and stuff. So how do we hold multinationals accountable? I'm not enough without this. How do we hold multinationals accountable when there are corporate leaders who sit on so many different boards and influence policymakers, and there's just this interconnected web of,
The interconnected web of shirking accountability. Well, there's a couple of ways you hold them accountable. But I have to say that I've learned that one way you hold them accountable is to ask them to be accountable to their own, to themselves. I know that sounds a little soft, but there are corporate execs that shirk accountability. But I, what I have learned is that there are a lot of corporate execs that don't shirk their responsibilities, especially if you open a door and give them the opportunity to address that accountability. And, of course, the classic example of that is what's happened with the chocolate industry. And Hershey's, which is not too far from here, I assume, has been a leader, a global leader in this, have been right out there in the front saying, this is a moral issue. This is not a bottom line issue. We are not going to put up with this. We are going to bankroll the work. We're going to lead the other chocolate companies. They've been fantastic. And they did it because they believed it was wrong and they knew they needed to do the right thing. Now, we were able to put together a kind of vehicle for the chocolate companies to all get into the same vehicle together and roll along and make that happen. Has it been perfect? No, not by a long shot. But it's the first time it's ever happened. So we're still learning as we go. And the good news is, about $30 million has been transferred out of the chocolate industry into anti-slavery and anti-child labor work in the last 5 years. $30 million, which never would have gone into anti-slavery work if we hadn't opened it to, if we had started off beating them over the head as opposed to saying, come and work on it. Right? That model that we call the protocol model, because it's based around something called the Cocoa Protocol, which is like a treaty that they all have to sign, is now... We're now to the point where we think it works so well that we're extending it to other industries. Coltan in the cell phones, steel in cars, gold in jewelry, and so forth. And we're going to try to build the same kind of models for those industries to bankroll the right kind of work. Now, the other part of this is in terms of accountability is that we have a law that's been on the books since 1929 that says no slave-made goods are allowed in the United States. But it's not enforced. So now we're back to the accountability of the government to enforce the law that's already on the books that says, you know, this can't be allowed. Now, admittedly, I have to say there are enormous confusions and problems about how you deal with that law. And it's very difficult because there's one last thing. I'm sorry to go on, but I can say one last thing about it, which is the other trick to this that you have to work to is the fact that no commodity has a majority of slavery in it. Or I should say, no, the majority of no commodity is tainted by slavery. Cocoa is maybe 1 or 2% slave tainted, steel 2 or 3%, gold 2 or 3%. It goes on and on like that. So you have this huge international commodity volume and a tiny fraction of it is touched by slavery in ways that you can't just say, you know, right, Hershey's, you know, what are you going to do? Because they don't even buy it from the farmers. They're not allowed to buy it from the farmers. They can only buy it from the state trading houses, by which time it's all mixed together in ways that you can't separate out the bad beans from the good beans. So you have to build these inspection systems and certification systems, and it takes a long time to make that happen. And it can happen, though, because we're making it work. So I don't know. I actually see the corporations as a huge funding source to get this problem solved as soon as you awake them to the responsibility. Last thing to say about it. Whose responsibility? Well, one of the things that bugs me about Americans' consumers is that they somehow think there's a moral watershed that exists right at the point of their palm, right? It's like, who's evil? The farmer's evil. The wholesalers are evil. The importers are evil. The exporters are evil. The processors, the chocolate companies are evil. The retailers are evil. Gap is evil. But when I buy this thing, I'm pure, right? I'm not responsible or evil. I'm the good person who can complain about all these people when I go and buy their stuff. Uh-uh. That chain of responsibility ends and lives in the consumer too. There's a culpability, there's a guilt that exists with the criminal who enslaves people. After that, there's no guilt for slavery, but there is responsibility to remove slavery from that product. And that responsibility lies with everyone along that product chain, including the hub at the end of the product chain, which is you and me. So I think we've got to get over this moral thing where we think we're superior to the chocolate companies and say, when are we going to stop shirking our accountability? I'm not pointing at you in particular, but you look a little shady. So, one last question?
My question was very
similar to that. Oh, okay. Thank you. Okay, so here comes.
Please join me in thanking Dr. Kevin Bales.
Oh, I have to say one more thing. So I just was going to announce, I've been holding up this book, which of course you can get off the website or Amazon or all that kind of stuff. But also, just so you'll know, I just got word a couple of days ago, there's a new book. I have a new book coming out with Ron Sudalter, and it's called The Slave Next Door. And it's a book all about slavery in America today. And it's the first really in-depth expose of slavery in America today, and it'll be out next month. So have a look for that, The Slave Next Door. Okay, sorry.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming. This concludes our presentation.